Welcome to the Rights Track Podcast, where we aim to get the hard facts about the human rights challenges facing the world today. I'm Todd Landman, and in today's episode, we're asking, are we better at upholding human rights than we used to be? My guest is Chris Farris, professor of political science at Pennsylvania State University, who has developed a new way of looking at how our respect for human rights has changed over time. So I'm really happy to welcome you, Chris, to this run of the Rights Track. It's interesting because I grew up in Pennsylvania, so I feel a personal connection this evening. I'm interested in talking to you about your research on human rights, and we're going to talk in general terms about your approach, the sorts of things you learn. We'll get a little bit specific about the way in which you applied particular methods. I wonder if we just start with a very simple question for you, Chris, and that is, do you think over the years we've got a bit better at measuring the variation in human rights performance of countries around the world, which is to say, are we better now than we were, let's say, 20, 25 years ago, comparing the human rights performance of one country to another?
Well, thanks for having me. It's an honor to be selected to talk about my research. I hope I can, if not change minds, help people reconsider some ideas they might have about patterns of human rights. That's what most of my research has really started to move towards. You know, I think a lot of people really are fundamentally interested in these patterns, both comparing across cases today and looking backwards a few years, a few decades, and even a few centuries to try to understand how things have changed over time. And it's hard to do that, I think. And that's been my experience trying to do this research, both from the researcher's standpoint. I think it's also hard to really take in all the information in one sitting or even a sequence of sittings and really understand the subtleties and the way things have changed. And I do think it's gotten a lot easier to measure things and to open up processes in different countries and to understand what's going on in real time. These weren't opportunities that were available to people interested in human rights abuse and repression and the actions of states in previous decades.
Yeah, so this is a function of increasing availability of information. Generally speaking, you feel that there is more information out there for us to make these judgments about human rights practices around the world.
That's my perception. I think if you just consider access to information on platforms like Twitter and Facebook that has over a billion users now, we're just awash in real-time information about individuals' lives, lived experiences that people are having in these different places, and not just in Western democracies, but in places across the world. There's an increasing amount of activity that we can go out and see for ourselves in a way that just wasn't possible even a few decades ago, and definitely several decades ago.
So we're going to come back to the idea of whether that increase in information changes perceptions and attitudes about people's daily experience and the ways in which they look at patterns and the sorts of conclusions they draw just from a sort of armchair perspective. But I want to go back to what I would describe as a splash piece published in a journal called the American Political Science Review, which you published a few years ago. And this was a kind of reassessment of the state of human rights in the world over time that really opened eyes and answered a deep question I had. And my worry, and my students would ask me this, and my colleagues would ask me this, does the fact that we are now more aware of human rights problems more generally mean that we are condemning countries more than we would have done in the past because of that availability of information? Or have things actually got better over time, but we've missed it because we're so exercised about the problem of human rights? And I think your article really answered that question. I wondered if you could just give us a short answer, are things better or worse? And then tell us how you got to the answer that you got to.
So the short answer is I do think things are better. I think there's a lot of evidence that speaks to that. And I think there's been a lot of evidence that's been available to answer that question for a long time. It's just been sorting through all of it, making sense of how the way that evidence is produced and understood has changed. And that's really what the changing standard of accountability really captures.
So could you talk us through that? What do you mean by a changing standard of accountability?
Simply put, I think today we just have higher expectations for what a state will do, what its agents will do, how they'll behave, how they'll interact with citizens. And not just that, but we have just the ability to look inside a place and see what's happening. We just have so much more information. We have so much more access to places. And indeed, I think there's even evidence that, you know, today we're categorizing, we're considering types of actions and behaviors to be part of a human rights process in a way that we weren't thinking about those actions in the past.
So what did you do in your analysis with this basic insight about a raising standard of accountability? How did you go about doing the analysis that you did, and what did you actually find out?
So to me, it's an interesting story from the perspective of how I do research. It was an idea that I had for a long time, and I'd wanted to test. And I thought what I needed was the full corpus of digitized documentation about human rights. So the documents that the U.S. State Department produces, the documents that Amnesty International produces. There's many other examples of primary source documents that are published each year that contain a rich amount of information about allegations of human rights abuse. And so I'd been collecting all that text data with this idea in mind that the reports themselves might be fundamentally different from year to year. And so I had this idea in mind, and then I was also at the same time working on some other modeling projects with the available indicators that political scientists, sociologists have been using for the past few decades. And I was working on these models, and then it just occurred to me that I could assume that this process was happening in the context of one of these models. And I put that into the model, and I needed to make a few assumptions about different types of information and the source material that was used in the development of the different indicators that entered the model. Once I had that realization, I went to my computer and wrote up the model and got it running and saw the patterns emerge quite quickly. They're quite striking. The difference is when we assume that the underlying source material could be changing and when we assume that it's essentially providing the same kind of information from year to year.
So let me just unpack that a little bit. So some of the dominant measures that have been used over the years include, and I'll just use one example for simplicity's sake that allow us to talk about this method a little bit, is the political terror scale. And the idea there is that there's information provided either in the U.S. State Department report or a Amnesty International report, and a team of coders will look at that information and scale that information on a scale of 1 to 5, where 1 is considered a very, very low violation, no systematic violation of human rights, no real concerns at all the way up to a 5, which was quite a severe condition of what they called state terror, the state actually terrorizing its own citizens. And so those are the indicators already produced. But you had a hunch about, they were assuming while coding that information, that the information every year that was produced was roughly the same, which is to say the quality of that information was the same, and they coded it accordingly. And yet you had a fix in there in your modeling, as it were, that took account of the changing quality of that information. Is that about right?
That is. That's a good summary of what I did.
And the technical technique is called item response theory. So item response theory is something that's used throughout political research and market research more generally. But in a nutshell, what does that involve?
So item response theory is a way of bringing together information and estimating an underlying concept from the available information. And I suspect most people listening have participated in generating data for one of these models. If anyone listening has ever taken the SAT or the GRE or any sort of assessment test where you sit down and answer questions, you've produced data that then goes into one of these models. And the idea is that there's some constellation of right and wrong answers that each of us test takers would produce, and that constellation of right and wrong answers is indicative or manifest of this underlying concept that the tests are trying to measure, which is usually intelligence or aptitude for some domain of knowledge or something like that.
Yeah, before I went to grad school in the United States, I did the GRE, which for those of you who don't know, it stands for the Graduate Record Exam. And, you know, I did 4 years of undergraduate education, and then I had to do this exam, which went right back and tested my English comprehension, my knowledge of geometry, trigonometry, and a little bit of calculus and some algebra. And, you know, by filling out these tests and taking these tests, what you're saying is that my answers actually give the testers an overall profile of my verbal and mathematical skill base. So item response theory is saying exactly the same thing. By using a battery of questions, we're actually underlying some discoverable attribute through these questions. So when these students code State Department tests and Amnesty International tests, they are basically coding an underlying phenomenon of the relative state of human rights protection in a country.
Yeah, so you can think of it this way. And to use the testing analogy again, the smartest people will get most of the questions right, people who might have some issues with maybe geometry will miss those questions. And then we'll just be able to put each of those test takers relative to one another along some continuum or some scale. And so what the coders are doing for PTS is they're using the underlying information that's manifest of a human rights process that's happening in a country. But it's being filtered through the reporting as well. But once those categories are written down, we can think about those categorized reports in the same way that we think about the right and wrong answers in the testing context.
So your study took into account that changing flow of information and that changing quality of information. And so this changing standard of accountability was something that you were now able to actually take into account and reanalyze, if you will, the scores that these organizations produced. Is that right?
That's right. So the idea was, just to belabor the testing analogy a little bit more, the idea might be that the test has changed subtly year to year, or that some of the questions got harder year to year. And if we didn't take that into account, how the test changed over time, we'd get a biased picture of how test takers in one year were comparable to test takers in another year. And so that's the idea that I built into the model that I used in my research.
And so the output of the model gives you a kind of estimated score for each of the countries. And does it have some sort of margin of error around it as well?
That's right, it does. One of the really nice things about this particular modeling tool that I use is that it simulates the process over and over and over again. And through the multiple simulations, we can get sort of a range of plausible values that each country might take on this relative scale. And so countries that we think might be relatively similar, we can say probabilistically whether we think they're the same or different.
Let's say a country, you know, like Brazil, 1982, was in the throes of military regime. On the political terror scale, it might be rated a 3 or a 4. And you could either compare that score to Brazil after its democratic transition, or you could compare Brazil in 1982 to Chile in 1982, which was under the throes of the Pinochet dictatorship. And you could, with some degree of confidence, say Brazil is significantly different from Chile, or we can't say they're significantly different. They're both sort of regimes that are engaged in pretty heavy repression towards their citizens.
That's right. And so the more information we have about a particular unit, in this case a country or a test taker in the SAT GRE example, the more pieces of information we have, the more precisely we can estimate the relative position of one unit to the other.
So this is really a more accurate way and a more scientifically pleasing way of comparing human rights performance of countries to one another than had been done hitherto.
It acknowledges that we're not completely certain about everything that's happened in a particular place, and that some contexts are similar, more similar than others. And we can be open to the fact that we can't be perfectly sure whether Brazil in 1982 was the same or different than Chile in 1982. But we can say, like as you said, with some uncertainty, how those two places compared.
And this is a real advance, because I think research before then would actually say Brazil, you know, in 1982 was more repressive or less repressive than Chile based on the roll score that had been assigned to it by these coders. And now with this method, you've added a degree of uncertainty, which is actually good. You've captured the uncertainty in that coding process and allowed us with greater confidence to say whether those differences were there or not. And that actually advances our ability in doing second order analysis and trying to look at why Brazil was better or worse than Chile during that time. And that's where I'd like to move now, is to talk about, so in what ways has this new data that you've produced been used by yourself and by other scholars?
So the data's only been available for about a year now. I made it publicly available as soon as the paper was accepted. So people have been using it. There's still a little skepticism about it. The algorithm is computationally complex, whereas sitting down and reading the reports and categorizing them, there's a lot of computation going on in the coders' brains, but at least as a process, it's pretty intuitive. You know, I still have students in my human rights classes learn how to do this, because I think it's useful them to start to think about categorizing the reports in the way that the PTS, the political terror scale folks, have been doing over the years.
Let's say you have a bunch of students sitting down learning how to code a country, and they happen to know that the country is, let's say, a democracy, or they know the country is, let's say, an autocracy, you know, an authoritarian state. So they're sitting down to code and they've got, you know, they've got the Brazilian military regime and they've also got Costa Rica at the same time. And Costa Rica was known as a democracy at the time and Brazil was known as a military regime. Does the standard of accountability change for them in their heads when they're coding a Brazil versus a Costa Rica? Or are they just reading the account and saying, You know, there's no repeated instances of torture and arbitrary detention, etc. Therefore, this country gets a 1, whereas in the Brazilian case, there are these repeated systematic elements, and therefore it gets a 4. Or is there something else going on here?
That's a really good question, and I think an important one. I would like to say that I think that political terror scale team and the Sanguinelli and Richards scale team, which produces a similar set of indicators, they've done a really good job, I think, of training their coders. They have multiple individuals look at the reports. They assess how people are doing in comparison to one another. So there's a lot of attention paid to this potential problem of bringing in a bias about whether a democracy is different or whether a certain place might be different. I've done a little bit of experimentation with this, and I'm happy to report, actually, that I haven't actually found any differences yet in terms of sort of loading the deck experiments where I've trained coders and then randomly changed the name of the report to see if the name, say the name Sudan, elicits a different response to the same content than some other country that the coder might be less familiar with. And I haven't really found anything yet.
So that's really great, because you're trying to, you almost eliminate the kind of leading the witness, and you eliminate the sort of natural bias that might occur just almost unconsciously when people are reading an account. In what ways have you taken the data further? What are you working on in terms of new research, etc.?
So quite a few different directions. So I'm continuing to update the data as new information comes out. I'm looking for additional sources of information. As we go back in time, there's less and less information about human rights practices. So the number of available indicators to put into the model decreases. I will say the nice thing about the model is information decreases, our uncertainty about the relative placement of those countries increases. But I'm looking for more information to help us understand immediate post-war World War II period, which is sort of a place that human rights scholars didn't spend much time studying because we didn't have data. Now that data is available. I'm also looking into using some of these techniques for other types of repression. So the political terror scale and all the data that I use in the article that you mentioned captures physical integrity rights. So the rights not to be tortured or imprisoned, killed or disappeared. But there's a lot of other human rights that we think are important and we think are related to these other types of abuses and to institutions. And so I'm trying to use the similar tool to build another a measure of those other types of civil liberties.
So there's a panoply of rights. There are other civil rights, there are other political rights, freedom of expression, assembly, association, etc. There are also economic and social rights, questions about the right to health and other sort of social welfare rights and cultural rights, etc. And it's not clear how one could imagine the violation of those rights. There's a lot of work that's been done on thinking about what is called state obligation to protect, respect, and fulfill those rights. And I think there's a emerging information of the kinds that you'll be able to use to add value to the ways we talk about those sets of rights. And that brings me to a really interesting question, which is this awareness and this changing standard of accountability, because we have views about the past and the present and the future. And current sort of conflict research coming out of the peace research institutes in Oslo and some of the work out of the United States done by Steven Pinker suggests that the world is becoming a less conflictual place, a less violent place, that the actual outright violence of one individual to another is actually on a historic downward trend. And your article suggests that human rights practices, when you know we take this rising standard of accountability into account, that things are actually getting better. So I wonder, in the sort of post-Paris attack period that we now find ourselves in, we've had 9/11, we've had the Madrid bombing, the Bali bombing, we've had the 7/7 in London, the Beirut bombing, and now the Paris attacks. People will have a perception that, well, with the rise of ISIS in the Middle East and the conflict in Syria and the collapse of Iraq and all the sorts of questions in the Middle East, that the world's becoming more unsafe, there's more violence, and that human rights are less protected than ever before. And I wonder if you just might have some reflections on that notion of long-term trends versus immediate observations for us.
These events that you just listed are tragic, and the images are salient and still in my mind, I'm sure in many others. But I do think that it's important to try to put those events into a broader context of similar happenings, similar events over time. And if you do that systematically in the way that I've tried to do with human rights, in the way Steven Pinker has done with types of violence more generally, I think you start to see that these types of events are occurring less frequently. And I think that's part of the reason why they stand out in our minds so much, because they become so infrequent that they're exceptional in the fact that they are unexpected. And there's a lot of different types of events that I think fall into this pattern. In the U.S., there's not just the climate change argument. There's also an argument about whether vaccinations should happen. And vaccinations, I think, have been so successful that people have forgotten the frequency with which diseases like polio and other sorts of diseases really affected the health and longevity of people before these vaccines came out. And so the relative infrequency of these events changes people's perceptions of them. And I think it's a fundamentally human thing, and that's why it's so important to try to piece all this information together in a systematic way so that we can understand how things actually have changed.
So the main conclusions of your work are, you know, if we really take into account the changing terrain and landscape of information available to us to analyze systematically and to take that into account when people are coding or observing human rights practices, that actually the trends are more positive than we first imagined. This is good news for the human rights community, which has been advocating the importance of human rights. It's good news for people working on political change and political development that, despite what we see in the newspapers and on our televisions and on our internet and social networks, that actually things in the long run are improving. So we can be somewhat cautiously optimistic about the developments in the world around human rights.
I think it is. And I think it's important to keep that in mind. And also, you know, there's still a lot of work to be done. And so I think one of the interesting things that my work has revealed, at least in the context of human rights, is that the increasing standard of accountability is a good thing. It's reflective of both progress and a desire to make things even better. So I'm actually encouraged by the fact that today's reports are more critical of governments than reports in the past, because I think we should be holding ourselves and our governments to higher standards than we were in previous years. So I think it's in some ways a positive story once you understand why the perceptions continue to change.
That is a great way to end this podcast. There's a real optimism in that, but there's also a kind of systematic statistical story that if we really take into account some of these changing things and have a clearer picture about what's happening in the world. So it leads me to thank you this evening, Chris Farris, for talking to me. This has been an excellent interview, and I think that our listeners will really appreciate what you had to share.
This episode of The Rights Track was presented by Todd Landman and produced by Chris Garrington of Research Podcasts. The project is funded by the Nuffield Foundation, and you can find additional information and resources at www.rightstrack.org.